is Tuesday, January 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The upcoming U.S. presidential inauguration is one like none other.
We have to send in 15,000 National Guard to protect the Capitol in a democracy.
Plus, Russian critic Alexei Navalny is remanded into custody.
Well, their biggest concern right now is the fact that Navalny has been remitted to this a real high-security prison in Russia.
We'll have these stories and more next. Except for rare cases, the inauguration of a new president symbolizes the American tradition of a peaceful transfer of power. VOA's Steve Reddish explains how and why Wednesday's inauguration of Joe Biden will be unique.
Throughout U.S. history, the inauguration of a new president presents a unique quality of America's democracy.
I, Dwight D. Eisenhower, do solemnly swear
the peaceful transfer of power.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Often from one political party to another.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Even after close and bitter election campaigns.
So help me God.
On January 20th, Joe Biden will take the oath of office on the steps of a U.S. Capitol scarred by an attack 2 weeks earlier by supporters of President Donald Trump.
Sir, are you at all afraid of taking your oath outside? Do you know what happened?
Hey, the incident further shrank an inauguration celebration already scaled back because of the coronavirus pandemic. Laura Brown is director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University.
Everything that an inauguration is to most Americans will be able to be accomplished and will be present on Inauguration Day.
The number of guests will be limited and they will be spread out for the swearing-in ceremony. After the inaugural address, Biden will oversee a military procession to reinforce a peaceful transfer of power. He and former presidents Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton will then go to Arlington National Cemetery for a wreath laying at the tomb of the unknown soldier.
My guess is there probably will not be a gigantic inaugural parade on down Pennsylvania Avenue.
Instead, a televised parade across America will provide what the inaugural committee says are diverse, dynamic performances in communities across the country. The traditional evening inaugural balls will be replaced by a 90-minute televised celebration hosted by actor Tom Hanks, with performances by an array of musicians from Bruce Springsteen to Demi Lovato. For those who did not get the message to stay home, it is being reinforced with armed forces.
This is also a troubling sign, like, that we have to send in 15,000 National Guard to protect the Capitol in a democracy before an inauguration of a legitimate election. This is not good.
Lisa Barton Short chairs the geography department at George Washington University and is the author of a book about the National Mall, which is closed for the inauguration, surrounded by layers of fencing to deter a repeat of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol.
You know, I'd love to be on the backside of the Capitol looking out across the big expanse of the mall. It's one of those views that just says, here is a landscape where you can read about who we are as America. The inauguration will be poorer. It will be impoverished because of the lack of people being there. And that's really sad.
When Biden is inaugurated at noon on Wednesday, he will become the 46th U.S. president. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
The FBI is screening the 25,000 National Guard troops being sent to Washington for possible insider threats ahead of the inauguration of President-elect Biden. AP correspondent Julie Walker has the details.
Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy tells the AP with rioters involved in storming of the Capitol having military ties, they're being extra vigilant.
It's clearly something we need to be conscious of inside the entire formation, let alone men and women that may be assigned to this its operation here in the Capitol.
The National Guard already goes through routine screenings. Now the FBI is also checking members out.
We're continually going through the process and taking second, third looks at every one of the individuals assigned to this operation.
I'm Julie Walker.
Acting Secretary of Defense Christopher Miller added Tuesday afternoon, quote, "While we have no intelligence indicating an insider threat, we are leaving no stone unturned in securing the Capitol." This type of vetting, he said, often takes place by law enforcement for significant security events. End quote. In a recent CBS YouGov poll, 21% of Republicans say they approve of the bloody siege on the U.S. Congress by supporters of President Donald Trump. Many more believe the November election was rigged. As the United States heads into a turbulent transition of power, Patsy Wiedekuswara has more on this divided and angry nation.
It's a scene that horrified Americans, with multiple polls showing the vast majority of the country rebuking the supporters of President Donald Trump, who forced their way into the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
When I woke up this morning and saw on CNN that this was the darkest day in American history, I was sick to my stomach.
But a CBS YouGov poll this week shows 21% of Republicans, that's millions of Americans, said they approved of the perpetrators of the siege. And according to the latest PBS NewsHour Marist poll, 35% of Americans say they don't trust the November election results, even though there is no evidence of widespread fraud. Steve Phillips is the founder of the organization Democracy in Color.
It's the big lie. If you say it over and over and over enough, then people start to take it as true. And so it's been the president and his enablers in Congress.
Up to 15,000 National Guard troops have been deployed to Washington to protect President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration on January 20th, amid fears of new violence. Meanwhile, this week, the House of Representatives impeached Trump for inciting insurrection, the second impeachment of his term.
The ayes are 232. The nays are 197.
As the president approaches the end of his term, the country is divided. While many scholars draw parallels to the period of the nation's founding and the Civil War, there is one important difference. Vanessa Beasley teaches political communication at Vanderbilt University.
Both of those time periods, who counted as a citizen was almost exclusively just a white man, right? So we think about who the American people are and how that's changed over time. It's also true that history gives us a guide to think about the things that will need to be put in place to make this moment transformative. Clearly a powerful president, and powerful in the sense of understanding the symbolism in the office and that it stands for all the American people, is one of the necessary ingredients in this mix.
While Biden has continued with the message of unity that he campaigned on, he will face deep challenges to heal an angry, divided nation. Again, Steve Phillips of Democracy in Color.
It's a very similar moment to post-Civil War. We had major struggles and battles around what is the nature of this country. And then now we're going to set about trying to push an agenda around building a multiracial democracy like we did with Reconstruction. Or are we going to continue to paper over these differences and just try to excuse without coming to terms with the fact that there's profound inequality and injustice in this country?
As the country deals with division, inauguration preparations are underway, with Biden set to take his oath of office on January 20th. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News.
A Russian judge has remanded Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny in a pre-trial detention for 30 days for violating the terms of a suspended jail sentence. Earlier, I spoke with reporter Charles Maines in Moscow to get the details.
The Kremlin told him that they changed a 2014 conviction that was a suspended sentence of 3.5 years. In other words, he never served real jail time. And they told him that once he returned, this would, for violating his parole while recuperating in Germany, he had violated, he would therefore was in danger of having that suspended sentence turned into a real sentence, in other words, real jail time. Now, of course, many of Navalny's supporters and Navalny himself saw this as an attempt to basically force him into exile. He chose the alternative. He went back to Russia. And what we see now is him attempting to essentially throw down the gauntlet to President Vladimir Putin, saying, arrest me, jail me, and let the whole world see these proceedings unfold.
The United Nations and others have called for the release of Alexei Navalny, and some countries in Europe have actually called for additional sanctions to be placed on Russia. What are Navalny's supporters, how are they reacting?
Well, their biggest concern right now is the fact that Navalny has been remitted to this a real high-security prison in Russia. It's under the control, or portions of the prison are under the control of the FSB, which Navalny says, this is the Federal Security Services here in Russia, that Navalny directly accused of actually trying to assassinate him, trying to poison him. So that's the immediate concern in terms of, you know, the fallout between Russia and the West and sort of the international view on this. Certainly we've seen Western governments, including the United States, condemn the arrest of Mr. Navalny. They've asked for his release, as you note. The question here is really whether Russia can bow to any Western pressure. What happens now? I mean, you can talk about sanctions. You can talk about, you know, international pressure. But Russia is already under sanctions. And so we have a problem now where I'm not sure that the Russians will have any incentive, essentially, to respond to this. Certainly heard from Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov today, who said that essentially the message was stay out of our business.
So what's next for Navalny and his legal team?
Well, I mean, today was a strange day in terms of the judicial proceedings. First of all, Navalny was being held in a police station outside of Moscow, just outside the borders of Moscow. He found out that suddenly they'd transformed this police station into a courtroom. He was basically given 1 minute's notice, as was his lawyer, that he was being tried right on the spot. Going forward now, he has this problem of this larger, you know, suspended sentence that the authorities are trying to turn into perhaps a real prison term. It could, means possibly 3.5 years in jail for him. Now, this is a case that dates back to 2014. It's a kind of a long, winding story, but essentially, you know, this is something that the European Court of Human Rights deemed baseless. Navalny himself says it was politically motivated to keep him out of Russian politics, which it has, at least in terms of the ballot box and to being on the ballot. And so, you know, I think we'll just have to see how it plays out. The events on Saturday when as Navalny supporters take the streets, we'll have to see the numbers and how many cities across the country it's happening. I mean, he's a national figure, but it's also the middle of winter. It's minus 20 something degrees Celsius in Moscow right now. And we had a few hundred supporters outside the police station today. Several of them arrested, but it takes a lot to get people out at this time of year, and so I think there's a real concern that the government will go forward with their plans as they wish.
Charles Maines reports from Moscow, Russia. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, warns that the inequitable distribution of COVID-19 vaccines between rich and poor countries will prolong the global pandemic. Dr. Tedros delivered this stark warning on Monday at the opening of a week-long meeting of the WHO Executive Board. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
WHO Chief Tedros called the development and approval of safe, effective vaccines less than a year after the coronavirus emerged a stunning scientific achievement. However, he warned that hopes of quickly ending the pandemic are in danger. This because the richer countries are buying up and hoarding all the available vaccines, leaving none for the poorer countries.
More than 39 million doses of vaccine have now been administered in at least 49 higher-income countries. Just 25 doses have been given in one lowest-income country. Not 25 million, not 25,000, just 25.
A global initiative, COVAX, was formed 9 months ago to ensure fair and equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines for every country. The organization has managed to secure 2 billion doses from 5 producers, with options to receive more than 1 billion more doses. But Tedros said plans to start vaccine deliveries in February to many of the world's poorer countries is now at risk. He said he fears a number of high-income countries may backtrack on their promises of equitable distribution.
I need to be blunt. The world is on the brink of a catastrophic moral failure. And the price of this failure will be paid with lives and livelihoods in the world's poorest countries.
Tedros said he considered this me-first approach self-defeating. He warned rich countries will pay a heavy price in ignoring the needs of the world's poorest and most vulnerable people. These actions, he said, will prolong the pandemic, and added that the restrictions needed to contain the virus will increase human and economic suffering. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Scientists said on Monday that previous infection with the coronavirus may offer less protection against the new variant first identified in South Africa, although they hope that the vaccines will still work. Studies also found that the new variant binds more strongly and readily to human cells. It is one of several new variants found in recent months. Others have been discovered in England and Brazil, which scientists worry are hastening the spread of COVID-19. The Party of Ugandan opposition figure Bobi Wine says that top officials have been denied access to their headquarters in the capital. This as they prepare to launch a legal challenge against Wine's detention inside his house. A spokesman for the National Unity Platform Party told the Associated Press that police swooped in on their offices at dawn, diverted traffic, and stopped people from entering the offices. A police spokesman said the NUP office had been cordoned off for security reasons, but he gave no details and did not say if troops had entered the premises. The Electoral Commission declared incumbent Museveni the winner of the January 14th election on Saturday, triggering protests in two areas. Wine, a former pop star turned legislator, came in second and accused Museveni of winning by fraud. Israel is pushing ahead with plans to build nearly 800 settlement homes on the West Bank before the Trump administration leaves office later this week. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
KOGAT, the Israeli defense body that authorizes settlement construction, confirmed the government approvals, which drew swift condemnations from the Palestinians. Palestinians see the West Bank as the heartland of a future independent state. The anti-settlement monitoring group, Peace Now, said that over 90% of the homes lay deep inside the West Bank. Peace Now's Hagit Ofran thinks this new rush of settlements will stifle the peace process.
Ongoing construction and approvals in the West Bank are very bad for Israel because it will prevent the possibility of a two-state solution and a peace agreement.
I'm Karen Chamas.
A group of conservative British lawmakers is issuing a word of caution about interacting with the Chinese Communist Party, accusing it of intensifying an assault on human rights throughout China. Henry Ridgewell explains.
From the incarceration of millions of ethnic Uyghurs in Xinjiang province to the brutal crackdown on protests and democracy in Hong Kong, the report authors say there has been a massive deterioration in the human rights situation in China the past 5 years. Benedict Rogers is the report author.
In particular, endemic slave labor, the development of surveillance technologies to create essentially an Orwellian surveillance state, the use of forced televised confessions, the implementation of new laws that allow within the so-called legal system for arbitrary detentions and disappearances, and the continued widespread use of torture and forced organ harvesting.
Among those contributing to the report was Rahima Mahmoud, an ethnic Uyghur from Xinjiang province. After witnessing the massacre of dozens of protesters in 1997, she fled to Britain. She now performs music concerts to highlight Uyghur culture. Mahmoud told VOA people in Xinjiang are living under constant terror, and she has not been able to speak to her family in 4 years.
A knock on the door brings fright to anyone, because you just think that, are they came to me? Are they here to take me away? I don't know how to describe my feeling, each time when I read these articles, the details of what is happening to the people, mass rape, sterilization, torn apart families.
Despite mounting evidence, China again this week denied the existence of Uyghur prison camps and dismissed allegations of forced sterilizations of Uyghur women. Zhu Guizhang is from the Communist Party Publicity Department of Xinjiang. He told a press conference Monday, what kind of contraceptive measures they take are all decided by individuals at their own will, and no organization or individual can interfere. There is no issue of compulsory sterilization. The British Conservative Party report comes as an increasing number of lawmakers demand a reset in relations with China. It's just 5 years since then British Prime Minister David Cameron hailed a golden era of relations with Beijing, but the relationship has since rapidly soured. Following the United States' recent ban on cotton and tomato imports from Xinjiang over concerns of slave labor, British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab this week announced new restrictions.
We must take action to make sure that UK businesses are not part of the supply chains that lead to the gates of the internment camps in Xinjiang.
Mahmoud wants Raab to go further and declare the persecution of the Uyghurs as genocide.
He has often remained saying that the genocide, it has to be decided in court, not by politicians. But then we know very clearly, we cannot pursue UN route because China has a veto power.
Beijing denies committing gross human rights abuses and has repeatedly called on Western countries to stop interfering in what it calls internal affairs. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
We're going to round out today's program with VOA Africa's Heather Maxwell, the host of Music Time in Africa. She recently had the opportunity to chat with Nigerian music artist Wumi in Lagos.
Wumi, how are you doing there in Lagos?
I made it.
You are poised to release your sophomore album.
Yes.
And you have...
Way overdue.
Way overdue. And you have two music videos that are from two tracks from the album that have not yet been released. And I am so excited because we are going to preview one exclusively on Music Time in Africa and Voice of America. Getty, Getty. The one that I want us to watch together is Empty Vision. Let's watch a little bit, and then we'll come back and talk about it. Your energy is just incredible.
Thank you.
Where do you get all your energy?
Water and life. Doing what I love.
Tell me about the set.
Well, that was all of One Love. One Love the Kubalo, who is an amazing Ghanaian artist. And oh my God, if you don't know him, please research. Literally, we used what was there as a set, as a tablet. So we moved around. As you can see in your trail, I walked into the yard. And as I'm going through, you've seen all this, what is happening. And that's literally, he scripted in that whole moment as I'm in there. The only thing we said was getting all those TVs layered up so that they would taller than me.
I've listened to several of the tracks on your yet-to-be-released album. And this one definitely has the most Afrobeat sound. I can hear that, and I really like it because I don't see too many female artists really embracing that and being able to match the energy in body with the energy of Afrobeat.
Well, that's the thing about, I feel, with Afrobeat, is that you can't be timid about it. You really have to, you have to ride it because the sound is so fat. Yeah.
The fashion and the dance is also wonderful in this, and that's not a surprise because you are also, in addition to being a singer-songwriter, a fashion designer and a dancer. Did you choreograph and design everything for this video, or did you have outside people as well?
No.
It's all Wumi.
I do everything myself. It's all Wumi. I always laugh because I'm one of those people who do not know how to follow instructions.
Oh, share it. I do. Who likes to win a yellow Hummer?
The message itself about emptiness, what has inspired you to sing about emptiness?
I came to Ghana in 2009. and I fell in love with Ghana, Accra, especially because it reminded me of the Lagos that I grew up in. I was sent to Nigeria when I was 4 and I lived 10 years. And when I returned to Nigeria, it wasn't the place that I remembered as a child. Going to Ghana for the first time in 2009, it was like I went home. It was like, wow, I remember this place. Then I decided I was going to come and record my album there. During the whole process, when I needed to write, I would get on a tro-tro. Tro-tro is the buses that goes around. And I would sit in there and I would wait for words to come to me to write. And Empty Vision came during that process of me sitting in the tro-tro, looking around me, seeing all the hustle and the anxiety and seeing what people are yearning for. And the words flew, the flow was easy for me to write it down.
I don't think so.
Bumi, thank you so much for joining me. It has been a real pleasure meeting you.
Thank you for having me.
I can't wait to hear the rest of your album.
And I'm happy that I got to be on your program to actually talk about Shimi. And I hope your audiences will enjoy watching Empty Vision and listening to the album when it finally drops. 2021, it's official. Now I said it on your show. It has to happen.
All right, Bumi, thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I don't think so.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. And with our top-of-the-hour newscast, you can always be well-informed on your local VOA affiliate. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a terrific Tuesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The People's Republic of China, or PRC, is engaged in a dangerous and destabilizing game as it works to at least double the size of its nuclear arsenal this decade. In a recent op-ed, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wrote, "Beijing refuses to disclose how many nuclear weapons it has, how many it plans to develop, or what it plans to do with them. It is the least transparent of the 5 permanent members of the United Nations Security Council." Despite the Chinese Communist Party's secrecy, the world does know that Beijing is pursuing a nuclear triad on land, in the air, and at sea, and that it is rapidly expanding and modernizing its capabilities, while simultaneously refusing to engage the United States in a meaningful dialogue on these developments. Satellite imagery shows the People's Liberation Army's advances toward building a world-class military by 2049. A recent PLA military parade showcased the Dongfeng 41 missile, which could strike America's shores in 30 minutes. The PLA, said Secretary Pompeo, will deploy this missile in silos and on mobile platforms in the near future, and we expect that, if current trends hold, China will at least double its total nuclear arsenal in the next decade. In addition to its expanding strategic nuclear forces, the PLA has fielded more than 1,000 ballistic missiles near its coast. Many of these weapons can be armed with nuclear as well as conventional warheads. Secretary Pompeo has warned that they are intended to target U.S. forces in East Asia and to intimidate U.S. allies and support the PRC's coercive foreign policies. Beijing's nuclear posture is becoming more aggressive, threatening its non-nuclear neighbors and calling into question its ambiguous no-first-use policy. By contrast, the United States and other democracies uphold transparency and respect for international nuclear weapons norms and are working to prevent a nuclear arms race. We participate in robust and reliable crisis communication networks with other nuclear powers, and we've encouraged Beijing to do the same, said Secretary Pompeo. Secretary Pompeo urged the PRC's leaders to join with the United States and Russia in crafting a new arms control agreement covering all categories of nuclear weapons. Secretary Pompeo urged America's friends to speak out. Too many countries, including champions of arms control who depend on America's nuclear deterrence capabilities, remain publicly silent about Beijing's buildup. History is clear. Great powers, including the PRC, must behave responsibly with the world's most dangerous weapons. Countries that appease irresponsible governments or acquiesce in their actions inevitably suffer the consequences.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.